This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Until they come home, that's the motto of the Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command. JPAC's job is to find fallen Americans from our past conflicts, identify the remains, and reunite them with their family members. This is a long, tedious job. It's hard work. The family members that do see their loved ones returned are grateful, but there are questions about the effectiveness of JPAC. They admit to being overly cautious and even faking some coming home ceremonies. But what have been your experiences with JPAC here in San Antonio? We're a military town. We have a national cemetery at Fort Sam Houston. Have you had your family members, fallen warriors, returned home? We'd like to hear your story. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org or tweet us at @tprsource. We're joined by NPR national correspondent Kelly McEvers. She has reported on JPAC in the series Grave Science along with ProPublica. And Kelly, welcome to The Source.
Well, thanks for having me.
So tell me about JPAC. What do they do? How do they do it?
This is an organization that was founded back in the early 70s after the Vietnam War. And at that time, you know, the concern was over, MIAs, people who may or may not have still been alive in that conflict, and people who had been prisoners of war and who maybe had died overseas. And so at the time, the main task of this organization was to, you know, sort of go over, figure out where these people might have died, and literally dig and look for the remains of servicemen who had died in these conflicts, and then bring the remains back home to the lab in Hawaii, where they're based at the military base there, and do the work that's required to figure out who these people were. Back then, we didn't have DNA testing, so it was a lot of manual labor, piecing together bones on tables, reassembling skeletons, trying to match what they saw on the table with, you know, records they might have had, dental records, other types of records that they might have had. Maybe some kind of fracture in someone's past could help them identify this arm bone with the person that they thought it was. So it's very long and tedious work. Over the years, what happened is that the scope of the organization broadened to include also those servicemen and women who were lost in other wars, primarily the Korean conflict and World War II. So that now they're tasked with looking for 83,000 people who are still out there who haven't been identified. Of those 83,000, it's thought that about 45,000 are recoverable.
So JPAC is part of the military. It's headed by a general. He's in charge.
That's right. He's in charge down there in Hawaii. But it's also a part of JPAC is a civilian-led laboratory, this lab where these bones are examined. And now, of course, where a lot of this these DNA samples are taken from bones and then, of course, sent off to another branch of the military in Delaware to be tested. Like many things in the Pentagon that fall under the Pentagon's purview, there are a lot of different agencies located all over the country that sort of handle this process of identification. It's one of the things that we found that kind of hampers the process a little bit. We thought from our findings after spending many months investigating the way JPAC does its work, one of the things that does slow down the process. Congress several years ago mandated that JPAC identify at least 200 sets of remains a year, and it's never hit that mark. Every year it's somewhere between 40 and 100 identifications.
So, but for the past 2 years, JPAC has been hit by some scandals, including fake repatriation ceremonies, a possible mishandling of remains, failure to embrace new technology, and misleading families. And people are asking for better outcomes from JPAC.
Right. I mean, one of the things we found in our investigation, we really tried to hone in on the science of it. How do they identify people? And what are JPAC's priorities? I mean, you've got a lot of different people here vying for influence within JPAC. You know, it started out as an agency that was focused on Vietnam. And then once its scope was expanded to World War II, that's a whole different conflict with a whole different set of concerns. And so what you have had was, you know, questions like, should JPAC be going out and doing these big expeditions in Vietnam and other parts of Southeast Asia where they're digging people up and trying to find them? Or should they be trying to identify the remains of soldiers that are already buried as unknown soldiers? I mean, there are tens of thousands of these in Europe and in the Philippines waiting basically to be identified with fairly straightforward DNA technology. So, I mean, that's just one of the major questions we found that is hampering the agency. And it seems like, you know, for a long time, there was much more attention being paid to some of these cases in Southeast Asia and to spending the money on the expeditions, while not necessarily spending the money to kind of just do the science that it would take to, say, match an unknown soldier in the Philippines to the DNA of his family that's come forward and is looking for him.
So there was a report put out by the Department of Defense Inspector General in October. It said mm-hmm. that there was poor leadership and mm-hmm. a hostile work environment at JPAC, and that was hampering their mission effectiveness.
I mean, we didn't focus on the workplace issues that much in our investigation. I know ProPublica did a little bit more than we did. But, you know, it's a place that, again, it's got an enormous budget and yet isn't identifying that many people every year. And I think there are a lot of people who work there who think things could be done better. There's the civilian heads of this lab have been in place for a really long time. And so, you know, we heard about a lot of infighting. We heard a lot of what was called ping ponging, you know, just like lots of just memos going back and forth, you know, cases taking much longer than they needed to. I think that was one of the causes for the frustration. But I think one of the things the inspector general also found was, again, this question of the science. Why now in an age of DNA, where we can go in after something like 9/11 or after something like the massacres we saw in Bosnia, if we can go in and identify using DNA, basically matching the DNA from the remains of the fallen with the remains of the family members who've come forward, you know, let's say in Bosnia, if we can get 400 identifications a year there in these very complicated conflicts, why can't we do the same with our own service members? I mean, there's a man just there outside of San Antonio. You know, his second cousin died in a POW camp in the Philippines. He was then later buried as an unknown soldier. His relatives did a lot of work. They've had paperwork that basically matched his dental records. They had a hunch of which grave they thought he was in. And yet for a long time, JPAC wouldn't even do the work to sort of dig up this grave and do the DNA testing. It took a lawsuit to compel them to do that.
Kelly McEvers, she is the national correspondent for National Public Radio. She's working with ProPublica. She has worked on a series about JPAC called Grave Science. Kelly, thanks for talking with us.
You are welcome.
We're going to continue our conversation talking about the joint POW-MIA Accountability Command and how they're getting the job done and what some questions people have about their effectiveness. When we come back from this break, we'll take your calls. The number is 210-614-8980, 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. These are the sounds of the bringing home 64-year Korean War Sergeant, Sergeant First Class Gilberto Sanchez. He's come home and was memorialized with full military honors at Fort Sam Houston. Sergeant Sanchez was a 19-year-old combat medic serving with injured soldiers in Korea when he went missing. His remains were found and brought back to Texas thanks to the efforts of the Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command. With us to talk more about that is the niece of Sergeant Sanchez, Imelda Aydar. Imelda, welcome back. Welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much, David.
And I, you know, I thank you for the service of your uncle, and his bringing him back home. How did that feel for you?
Well, I can tell you that for the entire family, it was a sigh of relief. There was bittersweet gladness because clearly the search for him had been ongoing for at least 40 years. But at the same time, we were very happy and relieved that he had finally come home.
I've read that families that have this type of situation where you have a loved one who went off to war and they never came back, that the grief continues from generation to generation until they get the results, that they find out what exactly happened, and then they're able to bring their loved one back. Is that what you found?
Yes, absolutely. And it's very interesting because I am his niece, and so my father was his brother. And throughout our family life, there would be discussions about my uncle and how he was missing and how there was a hole in the family. I was very, very, very young. I was a baby, in fact, when he left and when he perished. But I always knew about him. And it wasn't until this event that when they found his remains that I understood the meaning of the word closure. I finally got it. We all did, about how it felt to having home. And that really came about when they downloaded his casket from the American Airlines flight that came from Hawaii and JPAC.
What was your reaction with KPAC like? Were they very open and communicative with the family?
They were superb. I cannot say enough about them. You know, my uncle's remains were brought over when there was an exchange of remains with the Korean government. The Korean government gave the U.S. government 208 boxes, which contained approximately 500 service member remains. And they were all commingled. And that was done back in 1990. And DNA technology isn't what it is now. So it had taken a long time to have those remains identified and separated.
25 years.
They did what they call a mitochondrial DNA analysis, which actually looked at the DNA, the maternal DNA, and then they did an SRT analysis, which actually looked at the paternal DNA, and then they matched those with the remains of my uncle and his family. Oh. Once those were identified, then they notified my dad. And from the time they came to the house, my father's house, with the official records, and the casualty assistance officer, they were nothing but compassionate, professional, and empathetic.
Imelda, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story. And again, we all grieve for the loss of your uncle, and we celebrate his service and his life.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
So now let's turn, and we're going to speak with William S. Hilton. He is the author of the book Vanished, the 60-Year Search for the Men of World War II. And so, Mr. Hilton, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
So your book, you look at the pilots of the bomber, and they go missing in World War II. And even then, it's still a challenge to find those remains, identify them, and finish telling their stories. Is that right?
That's right, and I think that's a very good way of putting it. I mean, for the families like Imelda's who have lost someone without any explanation, it's a different kind of loss and a different kind of grief than what a family experiences with a wartime death, because there's a certain element of unknowability and uncertainty that's associated with the loss, and the family oftentimes racks itself trying to figure out what might have happened to the missing person. And you can imagine that this is a distinctive trauma for the family comes in addition to the loss itself.
Yeah, particularly because there's so many stories that people tell, fantasies or whatever you want to call it, you know, that that there are still soldiers from Vietnam in camps, and and nothing like that's ever been proven, or that even in the Korean conflict that POWs were taken to Moscow, that's never been proven either. We've never found any documentation to support that. So people's their minds go, and they don't know what to believe. And so finally, when they get to go to JPAC, and they get the letter, and they see the remains, and they go have the ceremony, finally that can all be put to rest, and they know how their loved one, how their life ended.
Yeah, you know, the psychologists who study this phenomenon refer to the kind of loss that the family experiences as ambiguous loss because of the unknowable ending. And I've started to think of what you're describing with a sort of related term that I just kind of made up. It's not in the literature or anything, but I felt like I needed some way to put a word to what I was hearing from a lot of these families. And I started thinking of these stories as survival narratives, whether it's live POWs in Vietnam, or I think a lot of people are surprised to discover that similar stories were pervasive among the MIA families after World War II. And there were 73,000 MIA families after World War II. So it's an enormous number of people, enormous number of families to be grappling with the loss. And many, many of them, I'd even go so far as to say most of them, when you speak with large rooms full of MIA families from World War II, have some form of this survival narrative. And maybe the guy is being or was being for a long time held captive in some kind of camp. Maybe he bumped his head and has amnesia after a plane crash or some kind of injury on a battlefield. Maybe he used the opportunity of the war to desert his unit and then continue the process of desertion by leaving his family and starting a new life in the tropics or in some other location, some glamorous location, maybe in Europe. And you hear all these kinds of stories. And the thing about it is, just often enough, something will happen in the world that turns out to give a kernel of truth to these things. So through the 1970s, throughout the Pacific theater of World War II, this vast expanse of islands, every couple of years, another Japanese soldier would emerge from a cave. And there were these sort of quirky moments in the news that for most of us are sort of marginal to our lives, and you just raise an eyebrow and you think, oh, isn't that strange? But for MIA families who were suffering from the loss and the grief of World War II and who were grappling with these survival narratives and wondering after 10, 20, 30 years how much credence to give these stories, those marginal incidents end up having a very central and sometimes corrosive influence on the way the family copes with the loss.
People hope is an amazing thing, keeps people going in the worst of times, but also it can be allow people to really want to believe things that are beyond logic, but they want to believe, and you can't blame them for that. But in your book, you vanished as you chart the course of these men who were these bomber crews in World War II, and the bravery that they had as they flew these rickety machines thousands of miles to deliver their bomb loads. You know, it's amazing, and of course, this is the least we can do is try to find these men and women, and get the remains back to the United States and put a marker on them. You know, unknown is not satisfying. It's not enough, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you spend time with these families, you certainly come away with the impression that this is a debt the country owes to these families, and that these families have, in a lot of cases, fractured as a result of the loss. So you can imagine that when some number of family members, relatives, you know, whether they're mothers or sisters or sons, come to the conclusion that one of these stories may be true or chooses to believe one of these stories or can't help themselves, and then someone else in the family thinks that's nonsense or believes it for a while and then decides that was just wishful thinking. These rifts form in the family. And as we all know, once a rift in a family starts, it often takes on a life of its own. And so you can see a generation or two generations later, these splits in some families where one piece of the family is really still holding on to this possibility that, you know, yeah, he'd be 92 years old, but what if he did, you know, what if he did get captured? What if he's still alive somehow?
Right, but so you worked closely with KPAC in the reporting of your book. You were with them.
I
you
did,
saw them
yeah.
How they went about their business, and you saw how meticulous they are. Sometimes to a point where you thought that they could be a little more aggressive in getting information to the families.
I think they could be more transparent. Yeah, I think that's a big piece of it. And of course, the research that Kelly and others have done on how the DNA science should work is important. I mean, we have to hold these agencies accountable to a high standard. But I also think that it's important for us to remember as we do that, that the work that these, you know, these field groups are doing out there is extraordinarily difficult. I mean, they might be at 16,000 feet on a glacier, looking at a plane crash and trying to recover tiny fragments of bone from, you know, burned up metal. And it takes time and it takes a tremendous amount of money. And we as a society have a right to decide whether they're doing it well and whether we want to fund it. And I'm glad that we're doing that. But I think at the same time, we have to try to make sure that we're making that evaluation with a real awareness of the damage that's been caused by these losses and how much it does mean to the family still.
Sure. The story of them digging up the plane crash that they found in the jungle of Vietnam, that of course happens. But more commonly is what we heard earlier. A government will turn over a box of remains. And is it really reasonable to say that it took them 25 years to figure out whose remains or who and finally get that back to the family? And how many members of that family that saw that loved one go off to war are no longer here by the time that box comes home?
You know, whether it should take that long or not is a question for scientists to evaluate, for other scientists. I can tell you that some of the countries that have given us fragmentary remains in the past, the remains, for example, have tested positive for formaldehyde. So there's a little bit of gamesmanship that goes on in the foreign policy.
Yeah, particularly with North Korea.
Well, also with Vietnam. We get back remains from Vietnam that they say they've just come up with, and it'll turn out that some of the remains in that batch match up with the remains from something given to us 15 years ago, and that they've been preserved somehow chemically.
It's a very complex story and one deserving of attention and time, and thank you so much for joining us. I sure do appreciate it. A great book, Vanished, The 60-Year Search for the Men of World War II. Will S. Hilton, thank you so much. This is The Source on KSTX, and when we come back from the NPR Newsbreak, the word of the year, #BlackLivesMatter. Stay with us.